From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. People who tune into the show know that I love talking about future saints and future American saints specifically. And we've got the story of Father Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin to talk about his birth anniversary is coming up on December 22nd. We'll be joined by Dr. Stanley Williams talking about the fascinating story of this priest who started out as a Russian prince, immigrated to the United States, and ended up being an exorcist priest and missionary, founding some settlements here in the United States in the Alleghenies. So very excited to talk with Dr. Stanley Williams later in the program. And we'll be catching up with Dennis Moran in talking about the canonization cause of Venerable William Gagnon. So we're talking about two future saints on today's program. Later in the show, we'll be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project for today, December 16th. We've got the Our Lady of the New Advent devotion that stems from Denver, Colorado in 1991. And it might be saint of the day. It is Blessed Mary Fontanella from Italy, who lived from 1661 to 1717. And the question of the week, does the Catholic Church ever consider multiple minor miracles to be taken together as one big miracle? I'll do my best to answer that one later in the program. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And this isn't a miracle in this modern moment, but it is the 70th anniversary of one of the most amazing miracles that the Catholic Church has ever recognized. And that's the Weeping Madonna of Syracuse. And it was such a big deal that the Pope, for this 70th anniversary, he actually wrote a letter to the Metropolitan Archbishop of Syracuse to sort of acknowledge this 70-year anniversary. So this was kind of amazing. So I'll read a short bit of it. The Pope says, 70 years have passed since the tears of Our Lady were tenderly shed in the land in Syracuse between 29th of August and September 1st in 1953. Human tears flowed from the eyes of the Virgin depicted with the Immaculate Heart in the painting placed at the head of the marriage bed. From then, the Church of Syracuse has carefully and devotedly preserved those tears, which often reach the sick, the elderly, the suffering, the ecclesial communities in various parts of the world, as a sign of the close and heartfelt presence of the Mother of God and ours. Mary's weeping shows her showing in the compassionate love of the Lord, who suffers for us, for his children, who ardently hopes for conversion, who waits us as a merciful Father to forgive us everything and always. So that's just the beginning of this letter, and he ends with a prayer that says, O Virgin Mary, accompany the path of the Church with the gift of your holy tears, give peace to all the world, keep your children in your maternal protection, sustain in us fidelity to God in service to the Church, in our love towards all brethren, amen. So that was the letter in commemoration of these tears of the Virgin Mary, and this was sort of an amazing circumstance where in this humble village, there's this Angelo Iannuzzo and Antonia Giusto. They were expecting their first child, and the mother, she lost her sight, and they prayed in front of this image of the Our Lady of the Madonna of Syracuse, as she later became known. And tears began to emanate from the statue, and they moved the image, and it still began to weep tears, and seems like the entire town showed up, and miracles happened. They brought the image to the police station. I'm not sure why they did that, but at the police station, the tears were continuing to come, and later this was investigated and approved by the local bishop, and they've built a basilica there in Syracuse to honor this weeping statue. Truly one of the strange, interesting, and fascinating miracles in our church, and the Pope actually got on Vatican Radio at the time to announce this miracle to the world, so this is a highly honored and recognized miracle, and now we see Pope Francis for the 70th anniversary of this miracle going ahead with this letter to the bishop in commemoration. People can go to miraclehunter.com and look for the Syracuse weeping statue, and you can find out more about this incredible event. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that gets the right answer. We give out the Miracle Hunter image of the faces of Mary. Last week we asked the question, what was the name of the hill that Our Lady of Guadalupe appeared to Juan Diego in Mexico on December 12, 1531? We had many people writing in with the correct answer. And Trish Schaut from Washington wrote in with the answer of Tepeyac. That is the name of the hill that Our Lady of Guadalupe appeared on. And believe it or not, before the name Guadalupe stuck, she was referred to by the local Franciscans there as Our Lady of the Tepeyac. So this was an important name in the Guadalupe story. So thanks, Trish, for writing in. We'll be sending you out the image of the faces of Mary. In this week's question, we're talking today about one future saint. That's Demetrius Galitzin, who was not born in the United States. He was born in Russia. And another one, Father William Gagnon, who did not die in the United States. And the question is a good one today. Who's the only American saint who was neither born nor died in the United States? If you think you know that answer, want to win the prize, send me an email. The question again, who is the only American saint who was neither born nor died in the United States? And if you think you know that answer, send me an email and maybe you'll be winning the image of the faces of Mary. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about the fascinating story of a Russian prince who turned into an exorcist priest in the United States. We'll be talking with Dr. Stanley Williams. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show know that I love talking about saints, and specifically future saints, and even more specifically, future American saints. And we have perhaps 24 venerables and blesseds on the path to sainthood. As outlined in my book, They Might Be Saints, and I feature on my television series, They Might Be Saints, which airs weekly on EWTN at 9 a.m. Central Time on Wednesdays. And we've come across another future saint, someone on the path to sainthood, someone who's a servant of God, and his story is absolutely amazing. We might say he's a Russian prince turned into exorcist priest in the United States. It's an incredible story. That's Demetrius Augustine Galitzin. And his birth anniversary or birthday is December 2nd, so December 22nd. So this is a perfect time to talk about this man on the path to sainthood. And we're so excited today to talk with Dr. Stanley Williams, who's a filmmaker and media creator for EWTN and otherwise. And he's the author of this fascinating book called Wizard Clip Haunting, A True American Ghost Story. And in this book, Father Demetrius Galitzin plays a central role, perhaps is even the narrator of that book that talks about this fascinating case of demonic infestation and exorcism. But it's an amazing path of this Father Galitzin, going from birth into nobility into his life as a priest, and as a missionary priest here in the United States. So we're so excited to welcome to the program Dr. Stanley Williams.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me. And you've done a great job. I don't know that you need me now. You've summarized the story quite well.
Well, thank you. Well, it's great to have you on. And I think that this story is fascinating. We talk a lot about future saints on this show, and oftentimes these people have come from Europe or otherwise, and they come to the United States, and they're a priest or a nun in the United States. But this story takes it to the next level. The background of Father Demetrius Augustine Galitzin is fascinating. So as we get going here, who was the man, Father Demetrius Galitzin?
Well, Demetrius Prince, or we call him Prince Galitzin, or the young Prince Galitzin, because his father was also Prince Galitzin. But the young Prince Galitzin was born in 1770, and is the son of Dmitry Alexevich Galitzin, who was a Russian ambassador to France and the Hague, Netherlands. And it was part of a great aristocratic family of warriors and statesmen and diplomats from large moneyed holdings in Russia. His mother, young Demetrius Galitzin's mother, was the Countess Amalia And she was the daughter of Count Samuel von Schmettau, who was the field marshal to Frederick the Great of Prussia. So at the time, they were stationed, when he was born, they were stationed in The Hague, but they were close friends. The father was close friends with Catherine the Great of Russia. And when Dmitri was christened into the Russian Orthodox Church, Catherine the Russia was his godmother and was there with great pomp for his christening. So he grew up hanging around with great philosophers like Voltaire and Rousseau and artists and things like that. And his mother was referred to as a great salonist, which means that a society woman. And she was very smart and always a great thirst for knowledge. And so that's kind of like the way Dmitri grew up. With
now he likely grew up in Orthodoxy, being in Russia.
Except that, yeah, he grew up in Orthodoxy. His mother, though, had been baptized as a Catholic, but she had given that up and fallen away, and kind of sidestepped into Orthodoxy, Russian Orthodoxy, but. Russian Orthodoxy was pretty blasé in the family. It was considered kind of like marginalized and not something you really participated in. But his mother was intellectually kind of brought back to Catholicism. And when Dmitri was 17, his mom came back went to confession and started taking the Eucharist, and Dmitri followed with his sister Mimi. And so they became Catholic in his late teens.
And why did he end up coming to the United States? That seems like a big jump for a prince of Russia.
Well, as was typical, after their secondary education, which occurred in Munster, Germany, and at a Catholic school, which is interesting enough, it was typical for young aristocrats to go on a tour of Europe or the world and further their education. But at the time, the French Revolution was occurring in France, and it was very dangerous for Catholics to go down there, and especially if you were an aristocrat and a Catholic, it was very dangerous. And so they decided to send Dmitri to America and the West Indies. And so but it was interesting that he was sent to America with a priest by the name of Francis Brosseus. And Francis Brosseus, Father Brosseus, was answering a call by Bishop Carroll to come to the United States to be a priest. And so,
and Bishop John Carroll is the first bishop of the United States.
Right, right. And they had like 25,000 Catholics in a nation of 2.5 million, and they only had, and Carroll only had like 20 priests across 500,000 square miles. So he was asking for priests to come. And Brosseus answered that call and ends up escorting young Prince Demetrius on ship. Well, when young Prince Demetrius first came into the Catholic Church, he was a very smart young man. He was speaking seven languages at the time and hanging around with these great philosophers. So he was a thinker. And he roomed with the Father Brosseus coming across on the boat, spent weeks with him, and understood what it was like to be a priest. And the whole idea of being a Catholic in Europe at the time was very dangerous. And yet when he came to the United States, he found peace and tranquility, and he found a very anxious Catholic populace, although it was very small. And so he said, he was here 9 days, and he said to Carroll, he says, I want to be a priest. I want to be, enter the seminary that you've just started with the supplicant priests who had escaped France. And so within 9 days of him coming to America, he entered the seminary. And Carroll was a little nervous about that because he knew, Carroll knew his parents and knew that they had planned for Demetrius to become a guard in Catherine's army. Hmm. But one thing led to another, and he was probably, well, at the time, the seminary, St. Mary's in Baltimore, was so young and small that at times Dimitri was the only student, and he was no, and there was at the most there was only five students in the seminary while he was going through it. But he was ordained in 1795. He was the first priest to be fully educated and ordained in the United States by Bishop Carroll.
Amazing. We're talking today with Dr. Stanley Williams, filmmaker, EWTN media creator, and author of this book, Wizard Clip Haunting, a true early American ghost story. And Wizard Clip Haunting, it's an investigation that Father Demetrius became involved in. Give us a little bit of the backstory of how Father Demetrius got pulled into this story, as you detail in your book.
Yeah, well, it's just really fascinating. I found out from a Filipino living in Australia who called me on the phone. He had seen some of my Catholic apologetic stuff, and he knew I was a filmmaker, and so he said, hey, you need to make a movie about this. Well, I did some research, and I found out that what had happened is that there was we'll call him a renegade priest, a priest by the name of Dennis Cahill, or Cahill, an Irish pioneering missionary priest who actually founded six parishes in the Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia area before Carroll even became superior of the priest in the United States, let alone bishop. And Cahill had run-ins with Carroll. But Cahill was introduced to Adam Livingston, the farmer where this infestation had occurred. And it was well documented, and people were coming from all over. And Livingston was a lapsed Lutheran, and he didn't know what to do. But he had some close friends who were Catholic, the McSherrys down the street, so to speak, in Leetown, Virginia. And the McSherrys introduced him to Cahill. Cahill came out and blessed the house and kind of subdued the poltergeist activity for a few weeks. But Cahill warned him. He says, you need to become a Catholic and be baptized, otherwise this is going to come back even worse. Hmm. Well, Livingston ignored him. And Bishop Carroll heard about this from Cahill. But because Bishop Carroll and Father Cahill had a falling out, Carroll did not trust Cahill to do the exorcism. He wouldn't authorize it. Well, Gallitzin had just been a priest for 2 years, and was up at Conewago in Pennsylvania. And so Carroll liked Gallitzin a lot, being the first priest he had fully educated and ordained. And he sent Gallitzin down to what was then Smithfield, Virginia, today it's Middleway, West Virginia, and said, go investigate this. And if you think it's really an exorcism, even though it's a Protestant residence and farm, I authorize you to do the exorcism. Hmm. So Gallitzin goes down there. In the infestation is real, and he's scared out of his boots. He's a timid guy to begin with, although very intellectual and astute, and he can't hold the prayer book steady enough to read the exorcism prayers, and he runs out of the house. And he says to Livingston, we need a more robust priest to do this. And Livingston says, well, that would be Dennis Cahill, because he's already been here and confronted the ghost. And so Gallitzin and Cahill together end up exorcising the farm. And there's a lot more to the story, of course. But what happens is that Gallitzin stays in the area for 3 months, interviews everybody, and he writes about it, and he writes extensively about it. And he says, after 3 months of investigation, I was soon converted to a full belief of them. No lawyer in a court of justice did more than I, nor procured more than your unworthy servant. So he writes a lot about the whole thing, sends the transcript off to his superiors at Conewago, and like a good book loaned out, it never returns. So when I was doing research for this whole story and decided that the screenplay that I had written and had gotten some interest in L.A. wasn't enough, and I discovered what really happened to Cahill, which is a story all of its own, I decided I got to write this novel. I had interviewed Betty Seymour, who was the postulator for Gallitzin's cause. And I said, it's Glisson's going to be the narrator of this book, because he's the only one that he was the eyewitness to it. He was involved in it. He wrote extensively about it. And he's a great apologetic writer. Even to this day, he's recognized as one of the originators of Catholic apologetic literature in America. And so that's how he became the narrator of The Wizard of the Haunting.
Amazing. We're talking today with Dr. Stanley Williams, filmmaker, media creator, Catholic media apologist, and author of the book Wizard Clip Haunting. It's about Prince Father Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin, an amazing story. And, of course, that wasn't all that Father Gallitzin did. He had incredible missionary work with the Loreto settlement in the Alleghenies area and beyond. And now he is actually being considered for sainthood. You mentioned you've spoken with the vice postulator about that cause. What can we say about the legacy of Father Gallitzin and his path to sainthood?
Well, he went up to Loreto originally. Well, at the time it was called Clearfield, and it was the McGuire settlement, the Michael McGuire settlement. And there was about maybe 200 Catholics in the area, and he went up there when he was at Conewago on a sick call. It took him 4 days of travel across the mountains, about 130 miles, to attend to this old this woman who was very sick and thought she was dying. And while he was there, he was so taken with the place that he ended up buying 328 acres next to the McGuire settlements of 600 acres and said, I want to come back here and be the priest of these wonderful Catholic people, because they were unlike the very belligerent Catholics and Protestants that he was dealing with in Taneytown, Virginia, and around where he was doing his circuit riding. But the bishop didn't think he was ready, so it took 2 or 3 years before the bishop finally said, okay, you're ready, go ahead. If you want to be the priest of these people up in western Pennsylvania in the boonies, up in the mountains that are just really isolated from everything, go ahead. Because there were a bunch of Catholics there that had petitioned Carroll for a priest. And so Gallitzin went up there, and he spent his money. His mother was sending him some money occasionally, although he eventually gave up all his inheritance because he had become a Catholic and he had left Germany and Russia. But he used the money that his mother sent, and he built a small church, log cabin church, and a residence. But he also built a sawmill, a grist mill. He built a school. He just put his heart and soul into these people. And when he arrived, there were perhaps maybe 200 Catholics, but when he died, there were 5,000 families at 11 missions that he had settled within 100 miles of what is now Loreto, Pennsylvania. And today there's a minor basilica there called that he started, and it was rebuilt several times. And it's just really a fabulous place. And there's a university, there's a convent of nuns, and the friars, Franciscan friars, have a big facility. And the University of St. Francis University is huge and beautiful, and it's established there as well. So it's a real strong Catholic community. And he's credited with at least, 3,000 baptisms within the first 10 years that he was there.
What an incredible life. We've been talking today about Father Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin, his incredible path from Russian prince to exorcist priest in the United States.
Yeah.
And we've been so grateful to talk with Dr. Stanley Williams, who's written this book, Wizard Clip Haunting, A True Early Ghost Story, which as its narrator has Father Gallitzin. And Dr. Stanley, thank you so much for joining us on today's program. It's been an incredible ride to hear what inspired you to write about Gallitzin and the role he plays in your book. And we're happy to see that this man is on the path to sainthood as a servant of God, and perhaps someday he will be recognized as a saint here from the United States. For people who want to find out more about you, Dr. Stanley Williams, and your book, A Wizard Clip Haunting, what's the best place where people can go?
Best place is to go to my main website, which is stanwilliams.com, stanwilliams.com. And there you'll see my Catholic apologetic work. And there's a big banner at the top that if you click on it, it'll take you to the Wizard Clip Haunting website, stanwilliams.com.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Dr. Stanley Williams, for joining us today and talking about the incredible story of Prince Father Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin. Thank you so much for being
incredible.
With us.
It is an incredible story. And thank you very much, Michael. Thank you.
God bless. That was Dr. Stanley Williams. Check him out at stanwilliams.com. And the name of the book is Wizard Clip Haunting. We've been talking about Father Demetrius Augustine Gallitzin. Who knows? Maybe someday he'll be on They Might Be Saints. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love getting the questions via email. And when I give talks around the country, maybe I give 10 to 20 talks per year, going to various parishes or shrines or conferences. And I talk about miracles. Been talking a lot about Eucharistic miracles because of the Eucharistic revival these days through the USCCB. But at the end, we always ask questions. We answer questions. And so, you know, people talk, we give questions for 15, 20, 30 or more minutes. And I love hearing what people are thinking about. So for people who want to invite me to speak at your parish or event, you can go to miraclehunter.com and click on the contact tab and send me a message that way. Now, this past week, I was interviewed in a pretty big interview on Sirius XM by Dr. Mark Siegel. You might know that name for his appearances on television and radio. And it was a fascinating interview for people who are Sirius XM subscribers. You can find that interview. Otherwise, I'll be posting to the Facebook page of The Miracle Hunter some clips from that great interview from Dr. Mark Siegel. He had a good question that I'm going to repeat for today's question of the week that I've never gotten before. And you know I get a lot of questions about miracles, but here we go. He says, does the Catholic Church ever consider multiple minor miracles to be taken together as a true miracle? And he was referencing that his father was 100 years old and had survived various circumstances and was still alive. And in his doctor's opinion, he thought all of these things were kind of small miracles along the way. And so he wanted to know, does the Catholic Church ever recognize a conglomeration of miracles, a set of miracles, when they look at canonization of saints? And the answer is no. It does make sense, of course, that we all have these circumstances in our lives that are beyond coincidence, that we consider minor miracles or small miracles that we see God working in our lives. And some people have more of those stories than others. I've definitely met people who can rattle off a series of inexplicable events. Perhaps they're not on the level of one of these capital M miracles that the Catholic Church would investigate and validate in Rome, but they still are significant in the lives of those people. And taken together, it seems pretty remarkable that the person's living a blessed life of some sort. And so to answer your question, answer the question there, no, the Catholic Church only considers singular miraculous events, and oftentimes I've seen in the submission of miracles to Rome that they've tried to bundle miracles together or talk about a major miracle and a minor miracle, and those will go in the sainthood file for sure. But when the Catholic Church does its full-on investigation with the medical commission in Rome, looking to see if there was a serious condition not liable to go in its own, must be an instantaneous, complete, and lasting cure with no medical treatment that relates to the cure, in those cases, they're not looking at multiple ones and bundling them together. They're looking for these singular events that show the intercession of a would-be saint. So that's a great question I received on that interview on Sirius XM with Dr. Mark Siegel. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to miraclehunter at EWTN or just go to my website at miraclehunter.com and send me a message that way. And maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we talk about the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day's date. And people all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. We just celebrated that big feast day, my favorite. But on each and every day of the calendar year, there's a different Marian title that lines up in some way to a different date. We have feast days, commemorations of miracles, the building of basilicas, etc. There's reasons to celebrate and honor the Virgin Mary each and every day and the calendar year all around the world. And so for today's date, December 16th, we've got Our Lady of the New Advent from Denver, Colorado in the year 1991. So the story goes that with the Jubilee year 2000 upon the world, Archbishop Stafford of Denver, Colorado decided to hold a 9-year novena to the Virgin Mary in preparation for the new millennium. As part of this run-up, he commissioned an image of Our Lady of the New Advent in 1991, which became the official icon of the Archdiocese. In 1992, the Vatican responded to the bishop's request for a liturgical feast day to honor Our Lady of the New Advent with the designation of December 16th. At the opening of the 1993 World Youth Day in Denver, John Paul II prayed in front of this sign-style icon, saying, "O Mary, Our Lady of the New Advent, who kept all these things, pondering them in your heart, teach these young people to be good listeners to your Son, the Word of Life." And that was Our Lady of the New Advent from Denver, Colorado, from the year 1991. For more information on this fascinating devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to 365dayswithmary.com, or pick up the book or download the free app, 365 Days with Mary, Marian Calendar, available on the Apple App Store. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about the people on the path to sainthood. We're talking about servants of God, venerables, blesseds, before they have all their miracles together and are recognized by saints in Rome. And so we always try to keep you up to date on who's coming down the pipeline as far as future saints go. There's been as many as 10,000 saints throughout history, but we've got many more in process. So earlier in November, the Holy Father, Pope Francis, received an audience, the Most Reverend Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, Prefect of the Dicastery for the Cause of Saints. And during this audience, the Pope authorized this dicastery to promulgate the decree regarding the heroic virtues of the servant of God, Maria Francesca Foresti, born Eleonora, founder of the Congregation of the Franciscan Adoring Sisters, born February 17, 1898, in Bologna, in Italy, and died on November 12, 1953, in Ozzano, Emilia, in Italy. And according to the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints website, they say she was the founder of the Congregation of the Franciscan Adoring Sisters. She was a religious woman full of hope and enthusiasm. She had suffering and disappointments, but she continued to abandon herself to the Lord in a radical gift of herself. She suffered the dark night of the soul, which united her even more to the passion of Jesus. And that is Maria Francesca Foresti, who is now a venerable. And with one miracle, she will be declared blessed. And a second miracle, she will be Saint Maria Francesca Foresti. For more information on these saints and all the ones we feature on the television program, They Might Be Saints, you can go to theymightbesaints.com. Let's take a look at the Might Be Saint of the Day. We also talk about those people whose feast day or death anniversary lines up exactly to the day's date. We have another Italian today. There's lots of Italians on the path to sainthood, as it turns out. They have somewhat of a home field advantage, I think. Blessed Maria Fontanella from Italy, from 1661 to 1717 in Italy. She was born on December 16th, and she was born on January 7th, 1661, in Baldarino in Italy, and she was born in nobility, one of 11 children to Count Fontanella of Santena in Italy. At age 12, she joined the Cistercians at Saluzzo in Italy, and unfortunately, Mary's father died soon after, and Mary had to return home to help with the family. 4 years later, over the protests of her family, she joined the Carmelites in Turin. And she's considered a visionary and a mystic, and she was the victim of numerous demonic attacks. She was the novice mistress at age 33 in 1691, and she founded a Carmelite monastery at Mont Calieri in Italy, and she was noted for her strong devotion to Saint Joseph. And she died on December 16, 1717, at Turin of natural causes, and was beatified on May 14, 1865, by Pope Pius IX. And that is the Might Be Saint of the Day, Blessed Mary Fontanella from Italy, living from 1661 to 1717. With one more miracle, she will be called Saint Mary Fontanella. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dennis Moran about the Venerable William Gagnon canonization cause. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People know on this show we love talking about saints and future saints at that, and future American saints or those who have lived in the United States. And perhaps there are 24 venerables and blesseds before they have their miracles and before they're declared saints. And we have in my book, They Might Be Saints, and my television show, They Might Be Saints, we feature these people who have lived in the United States and who have modeled for us the life, a life of holiness. And there's one that many people have not heard the name of. His name is Venerable William Gagnon, and we might consider him to be a missionary of mercy in the Vietnam War. And we're so excited today to welcome back to the program Dennis Moran. He's the former vice postulator for William Gagnon. So welcome back to the show, Dennis.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for offering me the opportunity of talking about him.
Now, it's a great he's a great future saint to get to know, and I think that he grew up and immigrated into New Hampshire. Talk about his early life, being the third of 12 children, and the deep faith that he showed from a young age.
He has some Quebec roots. I mean, his parents were Franco-Americans that came to New Hampshire to work in the cotton mills. And but the family he spent a part of his youth in New Hampshire, in Dover, New Hampshire, and also in the east of Quebec, and also in Barton, Vermont. So he was from a very modest family, and he has to work with his father and also with his eldest brother in the mills too. So. And he knew he was a good worker, and he knew to work patiently from the dawn to from sunrise to sunset. So yes, and in the at the beginning of the 30s, he considered the possibility of becoming religious, a brother. So he entered in 1932 in the Order of St. John of God.
And what attracted him to this order of the 16th century Spaniard? What drew him to that?
It's to take care. The aim of that order is to relieve the suffering people. Either poor or either sick sick person in hospital or in refuge facilities. So he had the will to help people around him. And so the charity, the virtue of charity, was always there in his art.
Wonderful. And from what I understand, he had started down that path to enter religious life, but his father was injured, and he had to be called back home to help with his family.
True. Indeed, he entered in 1930. He did his postulate. His father was injured, and he had to come back at home to take care of his brother and sisters, and to work at the mill to help the family. And so, and when his father was better, had recovered, he returned to Montreal to re-enter the order in 1932.
And how did, what were the circumstances under which he ended up volunteering to go to Vietnam? I know he had a lifelong desire to be a missionary. How did this all transpire?
He was happy to work in Montreal in the hospital, our Lady of Mercy Hospital. But as a young man, he had the dream to devote himself to elsewhere. So it was a kind of a dream, especially in the we must remember that in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, there were a lot of people from the province of Quebec, and also from France or from Spain or from Ireland, who left their country to do some missionary apostolate elsewhere. So, so for Brother William, he had that dream to go elsewhere, and it seems that Providence answered pretty well, because the provincial of superior of in those days went to Rome, met a Vietnamese bishop, who said, "Oh, I would need." Some male nurses in Vietnam, in North Vietnam, to take care of the refugees. So it was decided that Brother William would be sent with two young brothers over there to realize a mission.
Amazing. We're talking today with Dennis Moran, the former vice postulator for Venerable William Gagnon, who was declared venerable in 2015, and blessed would be his next path or stage in the path to sainthood. And when we talk about his time in the middle of this Indochina War, he was right in the middle of it, right? I mean, grenades were going off, and it had to be a scary place to be with being right in the middle of the war, with bombs exploding, sometimes very close. Talk a little bit about what Brother William did during those days.
Yes. At the beginning of the mission, the brothers were in the North Vietnam and during the Indochina War. And they started to have a house in Bui Chu, at 100 kilometer from Hanoi, and also they tried to open a house at Hanoi, and in July 1954, around that. The communists took the north part, so they had to the brothers had to go south. So and so they went south with all the refugees. It seems that it was about 1 million of refugees who flew from north to south Vietnam to escape the communist invasion. So with the help of the Redemptorist Fathers, and also with the help of the Catholic services directed by Monsignor Arnett, they decide to establish in 1956, near Saigon at Hanoi, and Hanoi in Vietnamese means the Valley of the Deer. So it was in the jungle. So they had to cut trees and to have barracks over there. So to establish an hospital. And that hospital is still works today, and it has been recuperated by the state of Vietnam, but it's still open over there.
Amazing. And one of the things that stands out to me is the brothers there who served at the hospital, and otherwise they cared for everyone, the civilians, the soldiers.
Didn't matter
who they fought for, and they just helped everyone. And especially when we talk about Brother William Gagnon, he had to do so many things as a nurse, as a contractor, novice master, fundraiser, social worker. He had many things to do when he was there. Taking care of the sick was one of the major things. Talk a little bit, please, about how he ended up dying. What was the end of the life of Father William, or Brother William?
Okay, at the end of his life, he was he devoted himself in Vietnam for about 17 years. So he was kind of exhausted, overwhelmed by the work to be done, and he had some heart problem, so he had to stay in bed for a few days, and finally he had a heart attack, and he died. He passed away on the 28th of February 1972. And so for himself, it was more that he had always to relieve others, to pray. During the day, his schedule was during the day, he relieved people as a nurse. And in the evening, he did some writing the correspondence, doing the accounting. And in the night, he went to the chapel to pray in before the Blessed Saint Sacrament. So he had very a full schedule, and during his life, he had already a reputation of sainthood. So he was considered as a saint even during his life. So when he passed away, there were people, lay people from the area, brothers, fathers, and sisters from various congregations who came to be present at his funeral.
Amazing. He was well loved for his great work. And
yes.
And he,
and I went to Vietnam in 2012, and I went to his tomb near the hospital in Onai Bienwa near Ho Chi Minh City, and people still go to pray at his tomb every day around 4 or 5 a.m. before going to work. So it's quite moving to see that.
Amazing. We've been talking today with Dennis Moran, the former vice postulator for Venerable William Gagnon, who was declared venerable in the year 2015. And he's now in the second step to sainthood, going from servant of God to venerable. And with one miracle, he'll be declared blessed. A second miracle makes him a saint. And as we wrap up the interview today, I'd like to ask, have there been any favors or miracles being considered locally or by Rome that would move him along to that next level?
There were some favors obtained in New England, in Manitoba, in Saskatchewan, in Canada, and also in Vietnam. But for Rome, there's a need to that those favors would be documented. A person can say, "Well, I've obtained a favor from Brother William, but it needs to be proved." So for now, we need proofs. And so far, the theologian in Rome studied his positio. Positio is a kind of a dossier in which there is the inquiry and the biography, and also a document about how he lived heroically the Christian virtues. And so after that study, the congregation for the saints decided to give him the title of venerable. So it's kind of it's like a little bit like the Olympic games. I mean, to receive the venerability, decree of venerability, it's like receiving the bronze medal. So, and there's a need for one miracle to be declared blessed and another one to be declared saint.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll be praying that he moves along the path to sainthood. Is there a website or another place that people can go to learn more about Venerable William Gagnon or his canonization cause?
The people can go on online to look for Hospitaller Order of St. John of God. There's a website prepared by the General Curia of the Order in Rome, and that website is there's an English version of it. So, and there's a section about the saints, the blessed, and the venerable of the order. So people can consult that website.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Dennis Moran, the former vice postulator for Venerable William Gagnon, who's now a venerable, and we'll pray that he moves along that path to sainthood, to blessed and then to saint. Thank you so much, Dennis, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you to you.
God bless. That was Dennis Moran talking to us about Venerable William Gagnon, one of the 24 Venerables and Blesseds from the United States who may someday be saint. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Dennis Moran, talking about the Venerable William Gagnon canonization cause, and Dr. Stanley Williams talking to us about Servant of God Demetrius Augustus Gallitzin. I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.